Today's Teisho will be case 175 in the koan collection Entangling Vines. 175 is entitled Kanzan's Inherently Perfect Buddha. The Sutra of Complete Enlightenment asks, if we are all inherently perfect Buddhas, why then have we become ignorant, deluded, sentient beings? Let's go on. Okay. So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice Zen at this session. You're doing a wonderful job. Some of you have been here for 4 days, and some of you are now on day three, right? Day two, and it's really wonderful to see such wholehearted practice. So thank you so much. And people have been coming into the Dokusan room, and it's very clear, deeply engaging. Zen literature is funny sometimes, and when they talk about people really being open-hearted, they talk about like oyster opening up so you can see all of its guts, right? So everybody's opening up, and in the most beautiful way, really wonderful, practicing wholeheartedly. So today's koan is really like a big question, right? I mean, Buddhist teaching is that all beings are fundamentally Buddhas. All beings possess Buddha nature. The Sutra of Complete Enlightenment says we are all inherently perfect Buddhas. And so then the question is, if that's true, how have we become ignorant, deluded, sentient beings? When we're given a question like this, our immediate desire is to run to our teaching, Buddhist teaching, right? And this is from the Sutra of Complete Enlightenment. You can run to the sutra and you can read it and study it. Or, we try to think it through intellectually. The Zen view is that that's always making trouble, right? That's always a strategy that gets us into a lot of trouble. It's very important to come back to your own immediate experience, right? Just come back to your own immediate experience. And of course, your own immediate experience is actually complicated, right? Very complicated, because we bring to every moment of our experience our whole history, a whole lifetime of past experiences. And so it's very difficult for us to simply be present with things as they happen. We have all of these mental habits that get in the way. No matter what the koan, the best approach is not to try to think it through, but to come back to your most immediate experience. But then that becomes complicated because, our immediate experience is often misleading, right? So that's why it's so essential for us to go into emptiness, empty mind. The story of the Buddha is really interesting story. The Buddha, it says in the Pali Sutras that the Buddha was just a sort of a happy guy. His father was probably the prime minister of the Shakya Republic. After the Republic was destroyed by a military dictatorship, basically, an expansionist military power took over, and that country, little country, ceased to be, people forgot all about Republican, Democratic, Republican government. And they described the Buddha's father as a king. But he really wasn't a king. A lot of evidence shows that they didn't, the Shakya Republic didn't have a king, right? But at any rate, the Buddha led a protected life, and basically was raised to be public official. He had an elite education. He married a woman from the Kshatriya caste, right? So somebody from his similar background, the warrior administrator caste, and had a child, right? And as we've been talking about, he should have been happy, but something he didn't understand was haunting him, right? There's something. It was like the Matrix, right? You know, he has everything. He should be happy, but he's not happy. It's like something's missing. And people, misunderstand Buddhism, right? The Dalai Lama is somebody I absolutely adore. But whenever he talks about Buddhism, he talks about happiness. The Buddha talks about happiness all the time. The Dalai Lama talks about happiness all the time. And, the Dalai Lama will, sometimes he'll say, kindness is my religion, which I totally approve of. But sometimes he says, happiness is my religion. And it's like, well, I don't know, you're the Dalai Lama, but, Because the Buddha wasn't really seeking happiness, right? He had all the conventional requirements for happiness, but he wasn't happy, and he didn't know why. And I definitely think that some unhappiness, or this desire for something you can't describe, is really important. It's like, one day people get up and they just realize, I don't want to live this life anymore. And people say, why? You've got it all, blah, 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 And the Buddha was like that, right? So, he, in the sutras, it says that he discovered sickness, old age, and death. And I've always been skeptical about that. I can't believe that even if he led a very sheltered existence, he didn't notice that people were dying, people were sick and old. I think what the story really means is that the Buddha was, the Buddha and his people were repressing these things, right? And we all do that, right? Our happiness is constructed out of denial, right? I'm not against happiness, so don't get me wrong. I'm having a good time myself, So I'm not saying happiness is bad, but there's a kind of discontent with life. It's almost like sacred, right? It's like the voice. You're living in a kind of a dream, and something you can't explain summons you out of the dream and says, go to Sesshin, right? Go to Sesshin. And you could say, well, what can I get out of it? I'm not going to get a promotion. But you say, I'll do it. And then, you get to 4.5 hours sleep for however many days you come. But what are you looking for? You can't even say. Right. So I think the Buddha had a kind of like sacred hunger for something he couldn't describe. And he basically violated the rules of his society, right? Which said, your job is to get married and have children and take over your father's gig. And the Buddha violated all these taboos. He abandoned his family, right, actually. And went in search of who knows what. And he doesn't say in the sutras he was looking for happiness. It's interesting,
right?
In some of the classic Buddhist biographies of the Buddha, there's all of this, all of these celestial beings who are watching over the Buddha at the time of his birth. And when he leaves home, he's watched over by all these celestial beings. And it's like, I'm sure it wasn't like that, you know. He must have thought, what the hell am I doing? You know, in the classical Buddhist literature, he'll say something like, I know enlightenment, I must pursue enlightenment. But I don't think he knew what enlightenment was, you know. So anyway, I think they're also repressing, right? The classical Buddhist literature is repressing, a Buddha in his worldly life was repressing sickness, old age, and death. And we all do that. You know, I've mentioned before that when my father died, I went outside, I went for a walk, and I was thinking about my father, you know, and I wanted to come back and sit with his body for a while. I mean, like sit like in zazen, and just be with him for his dead body for a while. And so I went for this long walk, and I came back, and I went into his bedroom, and it was gone. My sister basically had already arranged for the people to come and pick up the body. It was gone. So, you know, I should have sat with the missing body, right? But I didn't. But I was a little annoyed that my sister had not allowed me the opportunity to be with my dead father for a while. And I understand, right? We get it, we move it out of sight, out of mind, right? And I think the Buddha kind of felt that way. It's like, you know, we're all repressing a bit, right? And I think that the classic Buddhist literature is also repressing a little bit. It's saying the Buddha was foreordained to succeed. And that's not how it was. There's another koan in the koan collection, Entangling Vines, that I love. Somebody asked a Zen master, what is the way? And the Zen master said, a clear-eyed person falling into a well, right? It's like, oh, yes. So the Buddha, you know, basically set off into the unknown, right? He set off into the, he didn't know where he was going. And he studied with, initially he studied with two of the most famous meditation masters of the time. And they showed him how to get to emptiness, but he didn't think emptiness was enlightenment. And it's not. So he understood the importance of emptiness, but he realized there's something more, that's not complete awakening. And he started meditating on his own. He met some people who were also dissatisfied with the standard teaching. And they're known in the sutras as the five companions. So he's with his five companions, and they're trying to break through. And they're trying all these different things. They're fast. They fast. You know, they try fasting. They try meditating sleeplessly for many hours. And the Buddha went through all this with them. And then he had so little to eat, he thought he was going to die. And he decided, nuts, to hell with this. You know, I'm going to at least eat something. So he went to a village and asked, a local girl saw him and took pity on him. He looked so pathetic, this starving beggar. And she gave him some rice soaked in milk, and he ate that. And then he went back to his cushion. And according to the teachings, the Buddha started meditating. His eating gave him strength. And he started meditating again. And he meditated all night. And as the dawn approached, the morning star came up. And according to the sutras, the Buddha looked up at the morning star and had his great awakening. That's what we in Zen believe, right? Many people have stayed up all night and looked at the morning star and not gotten awake, because they might not understand, you know, what the significance of the story is. The Buddha, when he left his five companions and went off on his own, went through a series of stages, right? A series of stages that are called jhanas. And when we meditate, we're actually going through the jhanas. We don't call them jhanas, we don't think about them. But what, you know, they're actually just natural states of consciousness that you enter and exit on the cushion. And I wouldn't worry about it, but I think it's important to understand this koan and understand what we're up to. So, you know, the Buddha entered when he went that last night before his Daikensho. He went back to his cushion and he entered the first jhana. There's actually eight jhanas, but there's four jhanas of form. And, you know, there's a jhana that just comes from, that's the state of consciousness you get when things are quiet and peaceful, right? And you're secluded. And, you know, I think we all love that state of consciousness, right? That happens maybe, you might sometimes in your life just be able to close the door and sit quietly and have some downtime and listen to the birds and have a cup of coffee. And you don't know it, but that's the first jhana, right? And then, you know, the jhanas involve, then you begin to concentrate, right? You enter a thoughtless state, right? So you know, basically the Buddha went to his cushion, it was quiet, he was out in the jungle, nobody was bugging him, and he was having some downtime and relaxing after nearly starving to death. And then he entered a thoughtless state, which is something we all do, very hard to do. And then he enters a state of one-pointed attention, where the mind is focused, right? This process is familiar to all of us, right? We're focusing on the breath, and, you know, basically enter samadhi, and you become one with the breath, right? Sooner or later, enter emptiness, right? You finally enter emptiness. After you enter emptiness, that's the first, you could say the first four jhanas. Now there's other jhanas that we don't think about, and, you know, we don't concentrate on them, but, you know, we're entering them and exiting them. You know, so there's a jhana where, you know, time seems to disappear. Sometimes when you're concentrating, you know, on your mu koan or on your breath, sometimes you sit down and 25 minutes or 45 minutes goes like that. Basically in that interval, there's no time for you, right? Sometimes time seems to hang, it seems like, what, only a minute, right? You know, when you're waiting for me to ring the bell, that's a different experience, right? Then you've fallen out of that jhana, right? But sometimes you're in that jhana. And You know, sometimes you're in a jhana where, you know, it's like the world opens up around you. It's just like no boundaries are seen to, you know, that's a, you know, you may have this feeling like there's just no obstacles in any direction, right? And then, you know, there's a jhana where, you know, basically everything is, it's like a deeper emptiness where just absolutely nothing exists. And then there's a jhana where you have, it's really hard to tell if you have, you're conscious or not conscious, right? You know, people think meditation is about having a crisp, focused mind, right? So you're very crisp, you know, you're just, each thing is, and that it can be, right? There are states of awareness where everything is crystalline, and that's different. That's not what I'm talking about. But, you know, people who are beginners to Buddhism often think that mindfulness means you're constantly pulling yourself up and noting what's in front of you. So when you're eating rice, you're thinking, rice, right? So, but actually, you know, the higher states of consciousness are not crisp and precise, like doing math questions. You know, sometimes people will come in and say, I don't think I was dreaming, but I don't think I was awake. They'll come to Dokusan and say that. And, you know, if I wanted to categorize that, I would say, oh, you're in the fourth formless jhana, right? And you know, these are ideal, these are like a little sequence, right? And but people don't necessarily go in order, and they don't necessarily go from one to the next. So you can go, you know, in your own sitting, you could be sitting and you could be the first jhana, and then the next thing you know, you're in the timeless jhana, and then the next thing you know, you're in the jhana where there's, you know, you're not conscious of anything, right? You don't seem to be. So, and you can go up and down, and you can do 1, 5, 6, and so on. The early Buddhists were very interested in making, laying everything out very crisply like this, right? And they even say that when the Buddha was dying, they tell us what jhanas he went into. So as he's dying, he went back down into like the second jhana, and then he goes up to the formless jhana again, and then he goes back down, and then he dies. But you know, the important thing about Zen practice is that the Buddha was in the deepest possible mushin, right, we would say, just we'd say, that highest jhana of formlessness. And then he looked at the morning star, see. And then he has his awakening. And, you know, it's very interesting that, after he had his awakening, he says, he had this amazing experience, right? He has his Dai Kensho experience. And it was so mind-blowing and so impossible to put in words, right? That he decided that this was inexpressible, and he didn't know what he was going to do, but he didn't think anyone would understand. And then according to the sutras, a minor god, called Sahampati, called a Brahmi, he's a little god. He appears before the Buddha and he says, you know, if you don't try to teach this to people, their suffering will be never ending. So he said, if you, you know, who have had anuttara samyak sambodhi, complete awakening with no karmic remainder, when you in enlightened mind, you're always in enlightened mind, and there's no obstructions interfering with your perception of things. if you don't help people, nobody will. You know, and he says the world is lost if you don't take action. So the Buddha decides to do this, and he did it like until the day he died. He taught Buddhism until the day he died. So, you know, a couple important lessons here. One of them is that the Buddha didn't just have his Daikensho experience by going through all of these layers of the mind and getting to the deepest layer of the mind, which is formless and empty. It has no characteristics. Pure consciousness has no characteristics whatsoever. See? That's not what we do, right? Then the Buddha saw the morning star. So you could say he brings this mind of emptiness to the world of form, back to the world of form, see. And this is actually the method of Zen, right? If you really want to understand the method of Zen, you know, we're constantly going into Mushin, into emptiness, and then we're turning back and looking at the world of form. So basically there's the koan that goes, why do you put on your seven-piece robe at the sound of the bell? See? And that koan has two parts, but one part is the koan is sound of the bell. So, you know, basically you go into deep mushin. And you listening sound. And you know, everybody's going to experience that a little differently, you know. But basically, going into deep mushin and hearing sound could produce, you know, a complete enlightenment experience, right? It could. We're imitating the Buddha. Everything we do is like we're really following the Buddha's path. We're doing Zen. You know, when you come to Sesshin, it's actually like becoming a monk or nun for a little while. We're living a monk's life for, you know, whatever, 7 days or 5 days or the weekend, and we're following the Buddha's path as he taught it. Right. So we're you know, basically doing what the Buddha did. We're putting in the hours on the cushion, you know, just like the Buddha. We're not starving ourselves, fortunately, thanks to Imtiaz's wonderful recipes, right? But we're doing just what the Buddha did. We're going into the deepest possible formlessness, and then we're looking back at the world of form. And people have had Daikensho listening to sound. In fact, according to Buddha's teaching, the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, woke up by listening to sound. Right? But some of us don't have Daikensho listening to sound. And you could say, well, why not? Why don't we have Daikensho listening to sound? And that's where the issue of, you know, our assumptions and our presuppositions comes in, right? You know, we're maybe not ready to have that experience yet because we have some baggage that we bring with us, right? So, you know, basically, maybe when you, listen to sound, you find yourself getting annoyed by the sounds around you, the ambient noise around you. Many years ago, we had a sesshin here. You know, there's a Walmart down the street, and we had a sesshin here when there was they were building that Walmart. And people were in the Zendo, you know, trying to do Zazen or doing Zazen, and there was construction, all this construction noise. You know, and there was, you know, those little beepers on tractors and things. When you back up, by law, you have to have a beeper that goes beep, 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 beep. And it's designed to be intensely annoying, as it is, and it's a success, right? So we're sitting in here listening to beep, 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 beep. See. And you know, some people got really mad, right? Like mad. And you know, actually, there's really, you know, the truth is, there's no difference really between the beautiful singing of the birds and that beep, 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 beep. And you could say, oh yes, there is. You know, the singing of the birds is natural, but the beep, beep, beep is some guy, you know, came up with a patented device that he sold. Sold to every construction company in the United States. But actually, that's a karma, right? So when you listen to the beep, 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 and you get really furious, all of this stuff is coming in, right? You know, it's not just our assumptions about what's natural and not natural, and I myself hate that sound, but you know, when you're in deep samadhi, sound can be sound, right? And if you've come to Sesshin and you've made all these sacrifices and you're thinking, okay, you know, my ordinary life is so difficult and stressful, and I just want to detach and be in a calm place. And I come to the goddamn Sesshin, and what do I hear? You know, construction noise. And that, see, so much as you can see, that's a human response, but so much is going on there, right? It's not a Buddha speaking, right? You know, so much is coming, so much we have to work through. So, you know, basically, if I don't have enlightenment, basically I'm a failure. I've made all these sacrifices to practice Zen, and if I don't have I get the diploma, I'm a failure, and all of these emotions enter in, right? And you know, people don't like to not be in control, right? They don't like to be out of. So this is why, you know, when sometimes we listen to the sound of the whatever, we don't have Daikensho the way Avalokiteshvara does, right? So you know, the whole structure of Zen is to constantly go back and forth between absolute emptiness and the world of form. And we go into deepest mushin, and the koan is directing you to something in the world, right? Something in the moment, something in the past, you know, the koans have this power of bringing to consciousness all of these mental formations that prevent us from being fully enlightened, right? Little by little, our relationship to everything is transformed. You know, it's interesting to me that when the Buddha had his Daikensho experience, right, first of all, he didn't disappear, right? So the Buddha didn't there's a Greek play that I love. It's called Oedipus the King. And at the end, Oedipus has, it's not really, the Greeks didn't have anything like Daikensho, but he has this great insight. And then the thunder comes and the gods take him up into heaven, right? And that's the end of the play. It's like, wow, he's done it, you know? But the Buddha doesn't have Daikensho and then he's taken up into heaven, right? That's not what happens. He after his Daikensho, he got up the next day and he did exactly what he promised Sahampati he was gonna do. I mean, Sahampati might not be a real god, he might just be that when the Buddha had his Daikensho, he suddenly realized, oh my god, all these people are suffering. I have to do something. Right? So that maybe he is a metaphor for a thought the Buddha had. But anyway, he did exactly what he said. He said, I will help suffering humanity. And he sets off down the road, and he's looking for his five companions. And the sutra says that on the way to find his five companions, he runs into this guy that he studied with when he was studying with the two leading meditation teachers of the day. So he's heading over, he's had his daikensho, he's looking for his friends, and he runs into this guy who studied back at, you know, the meditation school. And the Buddha says, my God, I've done it. I've broken through. And the guy looks at him and, you know, the Buddha's like this scruffy, half-starved guy. And he goes, yeah, sure. You know, good luck to you, man. You know, that's what it says. And he goes, not quite in those words, but then he goes, it's like, good luck. Yeah, sure. So it doesn't go, oh my gosh, you're right. You know, okay, then he goes to the five companions and he goes, guys, I've done it. You know, and they all go, oh yeah, sure, you know. But actually, you know, he hangs out with them for a while and they realize, you know, you are really different. And they begin to get the vibe, you could say, right? And they realize maybe he has, you know. And then they start studying with him and he's guiding them through their obstacles and helping them to wake up, and, you know, they're eventually they have great awakening experiences. So you know, when we are working with a koan like this, what we want to say is there's a problem and there's a solution. Right? So you know, basically, enlightenment is supposed to solve the problem. If we're all inherently perfect Buddhas, then why have we become ignorant, deluded, sentient beings? So we want to see those things separated completely forever, right? You know, basically, we want to think about our problems as enemies of our awakening, right? Obstacles to our awakening. So, you know, actually, this is a big problem in Buddhism, right? Because it's actually very hard. You know, sometimes when people decide they want to be awake, that means they're saying, I want to be perfect. I want to be perfect. And that means I don't want to have any mistakes. I don't want to make any mistakes. I don't want to have any problems. And actually, a lot of spiritual groups are full of bullshit, you know? Because everybody's on their best behavior all the time. I was like this myself. When I first met Genki Roshi, I so wanted him. I so wanted to be a fully awakened person. You know, and, you know, when I was around him, I was like I'm not saying you should be on your worst behavior, but I was on my best behavior all the time. And, you know, I wasn't able to come into the Dokusan room and say, you know, I'm really jealous of all these other people who are passing their koans and I haven't passed any koans. And I feel like shit, you know. And I was paralyzed in my practice because I wanted to be perfect. And I didn't realize that all of my obstacles were the door to my awakening. You know, so the best thing, it was very hard for me working on a koan to realize how jealous I was of all my, you know, Seattle Zen Center friends who were doing so well in their practice and I was doing so poorly. And that was just something I didn't want to see in myself. But, you know, eventually I began to see that and I began to sort of like admit it to myself with some reluctance. And, you know, when I began to practice with Genki and later Webb, you know, I could make some progress because I wasn't running away from my imperfections. I was using them to wake up. So that's the method of Zen, right? The great collection of koans is called the Mumon Kan, the gate of no barrier. But, you know, every barrier is a gate. Every barrier, some of these barriers look impossible to pass through, but every barrier turns out to be a door. And there are no doors that are not first barriers. So every barrier becomes a door, and every door becomes a barrier if you cling to it, right? So, you know, basically, if you're on the Zen path, it's just like great Zen masters will say on their deathbed, they'll say, well, what have you got to say? And a lot of Zen masters will say, one mistake after another, a total disaster, you know. And what's that all about, right? Failure from beginning to end, right? You know, oh my God, what are they doing, you know? It's not a moment of doubt. It's like I'm not afraid. This is a unified mind in accord with the way. I'm not afraid. You know, I've made one, you know, every koan hasn't been a disaster. You know, every koan has been utter confusion. It's been a clear-eyed person falling into a well. You know, how wonderful that is. So please keep falling into the well.
Go, Bhuvan Segar.